Chairman has asked me to just plunge our desert into the substance of the memo.
And I'd like to
start
just an introduction.
Just to give you a brief.
See here, I have prepared, Candace has in more detail looked at
some of the current initiatives
that have come out in the legislature so far
in relation to
other states. She will follow up my presentation briefly. Start
then, I think
the first question that was asked, why is ethics a critical concern of the legislature? Or anything different about the nature of race specific for the answer to that is yes.
Both those concepts are embodied in the existing Alaska law in Title 39, Chapter 50. It called for the avoidance of even the danger of conflict. Recognizing then that ethics are a concern for legislators, the step then is to devise some method of dealing with day-to-day problems. So to take those general principles and get a code that works in administering legislative affairs. And that's a very complex task. It's virtually impossible, I think, to figure out in advance all the kinds of situations that may arise in the performance of your duties which may have ethical considerations. What the goal has to be is to develop some kind of general guiding principles which can be extended in day-to-day operation to those particular situations. Along with, there are certain easily defined and recurring situations, and for instance, contracting the state with the state, getting state loans, those are recurring situations that are likely to come up, which can be easily defined. And in those areas, you can get some more specific guidance. So what's needed then is a set of general principles, some specific guidance on recurring situations, some mechanism to extend those general principles to day-to-day affairs over the course of time, and some method to enforce the ethical provisions. One of the impetus for this whole issue has been the action of the Attorney General, who issued an opinion last summer stating that common law ethical principles were to be applied to legislators in the absence of specific statutory guidance. And I think this raises some problems for legislators. although the Attorney General's opinion tries to elucidate what those principles are, there's some uncertainty in the common law. Some of the particular issues are not well settled. There's conflict among the precedents. And I think that reliance on the common law alone is going to create a situation of confusion. This is not to say, however, that the common law must be rejected out of hand. There is a role for the common law to play in the application of any statute. All statutes basically set out general principles, and then when you apply them in real situations, you develop common law. So therefore, I think the idea of completely repealing the common law probably is an illusory goal. There are some aspects of the common law which will be helpful in applying the general principles you may come up with. However, I do think that the legislative enactment of an ethical code is a very worthy goal. It will give you better guidance than relying on the common law. It will accommodate, to some degree, public desires for reform. And I think the most important thing you can accomplish is to establish this mechanism by ethical considerations will be applied over time in the course of legislative business. And we have been very cognizant in developing our options here and looking at this issue of special situations in Alaska. We have a relatively small population, therefore the poor central legislative body that's putting a large load on that size of the body. And also in Alaska, we have some practical questions to resolve in terms of how do we apportion representation between the majority, the minority parties, and some of the smaller parties who have one or two members in the legislature. There are states that have these intramural bodies, and the record of these bodies seems to be fairly mixed. In some states, they've done very little, in other states, they've been more active. The other option we've looked at is an independent ethics commission, which would be external to the legislature itself. Representative Miller had an early draft bill that we looked at, which would assign legislative ethics to the purview of the Alaska Public Officers Commission. Other possibilities would be to establish some other type of independent commission to look at ethics. It might be staffed by former legislators, by retired judges, respective members of the community, and appointments to that committee would be made by the legislature. So the legislature would have control of appointment to the committee, but they would operate independently of the legislature. And those are the two basic options we've looked at for a control method. I'd like to briefly review you then some selected substantive issues in the ethical area, in particular those which were raised by the Attorney General's opinion of last summer. I think that there are basically two basic prescriptions in legislative ethics. The first is that you can't use public office for personal gain. And that includes some of the more easily dealt with areas such as bribes and kickbacks, the use of confidential information for your own purposes, misusing state property. Those are generally a little more easily defined and more easily dealt with and often are subject to criminal penalties, particularly in terms of bribery and embezzlement. The other aspect of it is conflict of interest, and that's a little bit more difficult, more ambiguous, and generally does not carry criminal penalties because it does have this element of ambiguity. Now, conflict of interest really has two parts to it. One is that if you are about to vote on some bill or take some official duty, and you feel that you have a potential conflict because of your outside activities, you must do something about that in terms of disclosing the conflict and perhaps abstaining from action on a particular matter. But the duty in regard to conflict of interest rises even higher than that. The legislators are called upon to exercise their outside business activities in such a fashion that they will minimize the possibility of those conflicts arising when they perform their duties. So the duty is not just to be cognizant of the conflicts when they occur in your performance of your legislative duties and to deal with it then, but to conduct your outside affairs in such a fashion that you can conscientiously perform your duties as a legislator and to minimize the possibility that you will have to abstain. I think this is made clear in the Attorney General's opinion, and also Senator Vic Fisher's draft had a specific provision related to that higher duty regarding conflicts. Now, what happens if you do have a conflict? basically there are two things that we see having to be looked at. One is disclosure of the conflict, and then abstinence on the measure in question. Most of the options we've looked at would provide for disclosure of conflicts either to the full body or to a particular independent ethics organization, and then probably being asked to abstain on a decision. And we understand that presently that requires unanimous consent, and that one vote can prevent someone from abstaining. We think there may be some problems with that. It probably does not satisfy the common law. It would have to be specifically changed by statute. And certainly, in terms of public image, there may be some problems because of the possibility for collusion. If a colleague can excuse you from abstaining, it's difficult to have public confidence in that type of process. Perhaps the majority vote would be a better practice than a single vote in terms of excusing a conflict. And we do understand and are sensitive to the quorum considerations in this regard, particularly because there is a relatively small body in the size of its numbers. There may be times when quorum considerations require a vote that otherwise may be that someone may wish to abstain on. And we think that that's a legitimate consideration that should be used with restraint in order to protect the legislator who is being required to vote because of quorum considerations. There should be specific statutory coverage of that issue. Now, I'd like to move quickly to what the Attorney General's opinion raised. And we saw three specific issues for legislators in that. One relates to an aspect of the conflict of interest, which is perhaps better called vested interest. That is, where you have an interest which is similar to the interest being advanced by some bill, not in opposition to that bill. That is, the legislator in question would be deriving some benefit from that action. The question is, when can you vote on such actions? And the AG basically set out two standards for that. One is if the benefit you would receive is not peculiarly personal, not immediate and peculiar to the legislator, he should be able to vote. And one of the ways of applying that rule in practice is to look at what class of beneficiaries would derive a benefit from this action. And if the class is large, or is the public in general, there generally does not seem to be a problem. Where the class is smaller, then problems are raised. And it's difficult here to give an arbitrary definition of. To use a number would be very arbitrary. And this is one of the areas that's going to have to be dealt with over time by some committee advising on particular issues, and we'll get more and more guidance as time goes on that issue. The second issue that the AG raised related to state loans to legislators. And he laid out some criteria relating to what is the size of the loans, are they generally available, how discretionary is the loan program in terms of who can qualify, and what's the interest rate, and what's the payment schedule, and how they're administered. He basically asserted in his opinion that loans which were generally available to the public and which had statutory requirements on all these aspects of the loan were not problematic for legislators. Commercial loans where there was more discretion involved did raise some problems in his mind, and I think this is an issue that the legislature is going to have to take under particular consideration because of the heavy involvement of the state in the economy of Alaska. Being sensitive to discouraging commercial activity by legislators, the idea of commercial loans is going to have to be looked at very carefully. The third issue that the AG raised related to contracting with the state. He basically asserted that the common law would prohibit such contracts with very limited exceptions. We have seen in our research that many states allow contracts which are perhaps de minimis in nature. That is, either the contract is for very small amounts, some under $1,000 or under $10,000, or the legislator has a fractional interest in this contract. And some states say the legislator's interest is less than 10% or less than 5% in this contract, then it's de minimis and they're not concerned about it. Some other states will allow legislative contracting with the state as long as the process is a competitive one with open bidding and public disclosure. There are some problems with that, though, particularly in terms of public image. public may feel that legislators have a better chance, even in a competitive process, because they may know the contracting officers, and I think those problems need to be kept in mind. There's another issue which the AG's opinion did not raise, which we also find is quite commonly dealt with by the state, and this is appearances before state agencies. And I think there are three functions here that need to be distinguished. It's traditional for legislators to intercede with state bureaucracies on behalf of their constituents. And in some of our interviews that we've had this morning with other legislators, that was raised, that they did not want to be unable to go in front of state agencies on behalf of their constituents. I think that function has to be preserved. There are two other capacities in which a legislator may appear before an agency. One is as a principal, that is where the action particularly impacts him. Some states will not allow legislators to appear as a principal. Others will allow them, a legislator, to appear as a principal if it's to maintain the status quo with regard to a business interest, to protect an existing business interest, not to advance or create some new business interest. And the other aspect is appearances in a representative capacity for a client. Some states will disallow that completely. Others allow that if you're not paid. Some allow you to be paid as long as the compensation is not contingent on the agency action. And these are also areas that need some legislative guidance on. So that takes us through the memo on the basic general issues on that, and I'd be glad to answer any questions at this point, or we can move on to the more detailed analysis.
Does anybody have questions for Ken right now? Okay, Candace, why don't you?
Okay, I'll be very brief in the interest of time, because I think what's really important is that some guidance be given for certain policy that needs to be considered under the area, under the issue of ethics. Given Ken's memorandum and in looking at the material that we had at NCSL, we start out at first with 16 different categories to sort of compare the existing law, House Bill 20, Senator Fisher's memorandum that we received, and to put this in a framework, given also additional information from other states, which we could then put in a format which would bring up certain questions that you could look at. I see a major part of our task to be posing questions about what could be considered under a particular category of ethics legislation. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory in here. I might mention, too, that in a lot of the conflicts of interest requests, which we get at National Conference of State Legislatures, it's usually after a problem has arisen. And the legislation is geared to correct a specific problem. And oftentimes, when a new problem arises, we get another request. And so in the interest of future ethics problems and making it easy on the legislature to resolve these issues, an eye to the whole issue of ethics and planning for what might come up is advised. We finally reduced the 16 different categories to essentially 7. They are the scope of the legislation, what groups of individuals will be covered. All public officials, legislators and their staff, to include former legislative members, maybe just staff people working with committees. That's one area that needs to be decided. Another area is the disclosure requirement. How broad do you want your disclosure statements to be? As you can see under item 2, I list different items which have been disclosed in different states. The number after the item is the number of states that have a disclosure requirement for that item. So you get some idea across the United States on what states have included in the legislation. Another one is a general conflict of interest statement. What is the sort of policy that will guide this body of law? And also you will see some examples from other states as far as a general conflict of interest legislation. Also in Senator Fisher's memorandum, he pointed out maybe activities that were not restricted, and because of the special situation that Alaska is experiencing, maybe something in the legislation dealing with what's not restricted, what's definitely not part of the legislation. That might be something to look at. Another area is the control authority. We have an internal peer review body, a select committee, a standing committee. We have an external commission. What's the selection procedure for the members of those of that committee or that body that would be reviewing the situation? What are some of the powers and the duties that this commission has? Those are things that, that need to have some attention placed on them. The last item is penalties. You make a statement and you want a certain effect from this legislation. How are you going to enforce it? What enforcement powers are going to be part of this? And then the last item I have included, we've included, is other items that were either included in a proposed House bill, in a memorandum, other items of interest that states have included in their conflict of interest legislation. And after reviewing this, if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Candace, that's very complete. Are there any questions from the committee?
I, for one, am very appreciative of having it laid out like this. This is really super. Are there any questions from the... Yes,
Representative Phillips. Yeah, sure. I just want to explain that. I think there's a difference between conflict of interest and a code of ethics. Maybe even, I know most people need some ethics, and I know it's all one and the same as far as presentation. But, maybe you can explain your interpretation of conflict and what is code of ethics.
I think that a complete code of ethics would be one that dealt with conflict of interest issues. That conflict of interest is one of the ethical considerations which should be taken under consideration in a code. Perhaps you could explain to me the difference.
Okay, in my mind, we're in the process of drafting conflict of interest legislation. And I think whatever we don't cover, the areas that we don't cover, should be under a code of ethics, except the code of ethics.
Well,
the way I'm looking at it this time.
One way to approach it would say that conflict of interest is the most pressing problem you have to deal with immediately, and there are other ethical issues we may be looked at subsequently and added on. On the other hand, I think both of the working drafts that we've seen, HB 20 and Senator Dick Fisher's Senate bill, are comprehensive in their coverage and would include both conflict of interest situations and other issues that may arise.
Yes, Senator Ray?
Yes, I think Robin is recognizing their interlocking conflict and looking at some ethical considerations. Financial disclosure, which I suppose would come under conflict of interest, more or less. But as far as ethics, we have a general rundown of the common law that the Attorney General gave us a goodbye kiss on his way out. And we've been saying that for most of the 30 years until we couldn't find any other place to put it. But I think. As far as I'm concerned, it's just one man's opinion. I want to concentrate on the problems that Alaska has and not in relationship to the other states. I don't care what they do in Oklahoma. I don't care what they do in Idaho. Although it's nice to have formed out here, we can use that. But Alaska has so many different problems, as you've outlined here in your overview. Small population and scattered villages where maybe the only guy in town that owns a building is going to run for office. Those kind of considerations. And I hope that you will assist us in that matter and identifying or even isolating after we identify those problems and work on those specific Alaska problems.
Representative Miller?
Yeah, just a couple points that I'm sure. First of all, on this, which is a very nice relate, I think, one small correction. Under House Bill 20, it applies not only to the governor, lieutenant governor, but all public employees. You probably realize that. I don't think we'll be totally clear from this. So The other point I wanted to make was, in your discussion in here, you laid out several options for us. One of the options you laid out was to do nothing immediately, but to have a to allow for more time over the interim to deal with the questions that were raised by the Attorney General. And it was good by this, even my colleague finished it. Unfortunately, the new Attorney General gave us a hell of a smooch using the same language. And so we're sort of, we are under the gun. And so that option probably doesn't exist, except I was curious if perhaps you had talked to the Attorney General's office and they were willing to not move into an enforcement mode right away, in which case then this would be an option, and I think would be a very wise option. One of the reasons in the House we've been in such a hurry on this is because we feel like we're under the gun from the Attorney General. But if the Attorney General is not in that much of a hurry, then I think a more deliberative and a little bit more thoughtful treatment over the interim would be very, very wise treatment indeed. And I was curious if you had been in contact with him, and that was the reason for the option.
I have been in contact with Tom Jenkins in that office, but we did not discuss this at all. I just wanted to know if he had a bill. I was under the impression that they would come up with a proposal.
Yeah, okay. Well, I thought maybe since that office was there, that perhaps that was something they didn't mention.
Okay, but rather than not, right now, they're still planning to go into the enforcement mode, and there is no option for delay. But thank you, too. And let's bring on the Attorney General's staff. Is Dean Guanelli and Diane Colvin here? Great. Did everyone receive? Jen, does everyone have a copy of the Attorney General? Could you pass this out?
Yeah.
No. Could you pass this out? Okay. I'll get mine too. Thank you. All right, Dean and Diane, why don't you begin?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dean Guanelli. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. With me is Diane Colvin from the Civil Division. What we have been asked to do a couple of weeks ago was to come
up. Excuse me, Dean, could you speak a little louder, please?
Certainly. What we were asked to do a couple of weeks ago was to draft some legislation regarding conflict of interest and ethics in government. We have been in the process of doing that, but we have not completed it. As the first speaker has demonstrated, there are a number of policy issues that are quite complicated, and it's a difficult thing to do. What we were specifically asked to do today was to come forward and bring to the committee a brief outline of what we would consider to be an appropriate piece of legislation and what that legislation should cover. And what we've brought before you is a three-page outline entitled Outline of Main Features and Policy Considerations for Proposed Conflict of Interest and Ethics Legislation. In that outline, and I'm not going to go over it in any detail, I think we set out a number of provisions that we think would be appropriate for any ethics legislation. As an initial matter, I should probably say that the primary policy decision that needs to be made right now is whether any legislation should cover just the legislative branch or should cover all three branches of government. We would propose that legislation cover all branches of government and all public officials. The Attorney General's opinion did not limit itself certainly to one branch of government. What constitutes a conflict of interest for a legislator certainly would constitute a conflict of interest for any public official, although there are certain things that that are strictly legislative in nature. So our proposed legislation, when we draft it, would cover all branches of government. In doing so, one decision that needs to be made is whether the agency which reviews all three branches of government is going to be the same agency, or whether each branch of government is going to have a separate ethics agency to review the matters that come before it. For a variety of reasons, we would favor separate agencies for each branch of government. What we have brought before you is, first of all, a list of prohibited conduct. This list.
Excuse me, Dean. Just
yes.
So I get this clear, you're recommending that the legislation cover all three branches of government down to
That's
what
right.
level?
Down to what level?
Would the municipal government officials be covered?
The municipal officials, that's certainly a policy decision that needs to be made. Currently, municipal officials must file financial disclosure statements with the APOC. It would seem appropriate to also cover them in any kind of ethics legislation, or let them opt out if they decide not to be covered by, for example, the APOC. They want to handle their own conflicts, interests, and ethics matters within their own house, within their own community. Let them decide to do that by a vote of the assembly, otherwise be covered by the Public Offices Commission or some other body.
All right, if I could, one more question then. On separate ethics agencies, for instance, that would be an ethics agency for the legislative branch, the judicial branch, which I believe sort of has one already, or in the administrative branch?
There would be an ethics agency for the executive branch, one for the legislative, one for the judicial, and then it would be a decision whether to allow the municipalities to do their own thing or be covered by the same agency that covers the executive branch.
Okay. Senator
Raven. Isn't their activity on the municipal level is far more gratifying at times than it certainly is in the legislature. You could be a bigger thief than the city assembly or in one of the planning and zoning commissions than you could ever be as a member of the legislature.
I agree, and I guess for that reason that some of their activity ought to be covered.
Representative Locke,
I believe that the AG's opinion that was the case of a goodbye kiss and a big hug referred itself to all public officials, which definitely includes municipalities, so they have a problem just like we do.
Okay, continue, Dean.
I mean, this is definitely a major piece of legislation that is contemplated. I hope that by perhaps my expanding what this committee thought it might be dealing with in the future, that I don't place a kiss of death on any kind of legislation. In any event, what we have listed out here is a list of prohibited conduct. Certainly there is a general definition of conflict of interest which we have proposed here, but then there ought to be a list of specific conduct that should not be engaged in. What we have proposed here are very broadly worded categories of conduct that create conflicts of interest. Obviously, many of these broad categories will cover situations that might not be intended by this committee and by the legislature, and they ought to be carefully considered. With a citizen legislature such as we have, many people have to have some sort of outside employment. There has to be some consideration for allowing those kinds of business activities to continue. But I think that what's important and what the first speaker emphasized is that not only do we have to be concerned with the fact of a conflict of interest, the fact that something improper is going on, but the appearance also. The canons of ethics of the legal profession are very concerned with the appearance of impropriety. And I think to the extent that we have broadly worded categories, we are covering those situations that might not necessarily create an actual conflict, but which look bad.
Excuse me, Senator Ray has
the comment. Before we go any farther, would you take the prohibited conduct there and go down and so I'll be able to understand what you're saying? In general, a conflict of interest exists if a public official must take official action which would detrimentally affect a business, property, contract, venture, or transaction with the public official and the financial interest?
Well, a public official may take action which would benefit himself, but if the action which he ought to be taking in the public interest works against his business interest, then he may fail to take that action. So if there's a situation where him making a decision would cause him to lose money, then I think that there is a potential conflict of interest in him having to make that decision or failing to make that decision. And that's what we want to cover. I mean, there are situations where people will lose money if they take some action, but that action ought to be taken in the public interest.
Well, that's what you mean by
detrimentally. Yeah, that's not.
Reconstruct that because it.
We have not drafted this as a piece of draft legislation.
Well, no, but I mean, longer understanding what you're talking about. Okay, I couldn't make up my mind what you were saying. That's why I had to stop you. Thank you.
And please, members of the committee, if you have a question, we're here to stop him.
Well, the maybe I can just respond to questions on the first on the list is contracts with state and local governments involving an agency that could be influenced by the person who is contracting. What we've had in mind here is, for example, a state employee in the Department of Administration who is in the supply division and who on the side has a business that supplies a certain product that the state uses all the time. There is a conflict of interest if that person is buying from his own business, obviously. There is also a conflict of interest if, for example, Mr. Janke, who isn't here today, as legal advisor to the Department of Administration and with some influence over the Department of Administration, is also selling goods to that department. Now, what gets us into problems is with legislators. Obviously, legislators have influence over every department within state government.
Theoretically.
Go ahead, Pete.
Well,
I feel like
that's certainly an area that's got to be considered. Whether we're going to prohibit legislators from within, for example, a competitive bidding process, from dealing with state agencies, and I think we would say that probably not prohibit that.
Be sure and put in there a third person. We got contracts with a third person. You know what I'm saying?
Buddy, right? Sure.
Some buddy, and I do good for him, and he takes care of me. Which wouldn't be me making a contract at all. It would actually be for a third person, as he might.
Okay, that's certainly something that Senator Fisher's bill addresses and uses the phrase, I think, close economic association. If there's a close economic association between a public official and some third party, that kind of contract should also be.
Now, Dean, you're saying that contracts with involving agencies, specifically sole source contracts and including contracts that are in a 12-month termination part, would be prohibited.
Again, we've got to sort of be careful about what things we're going to include and what things we're going to exclude within those two categories. If there is a true competitive bid process, or if there are very good reasons why someone has to be the sole source of a certain product, then I suppose that those could be allowed. But again, we're talking about the appearances of impropriety. If a legislator is going to be the sole source of a particular product or item or piece of property, that is going to look bad. And perhaps what we ought to do in those circumstances is have the legislator refer that matter to the ethics agency to make a determination whether the proper procedures have been filed, and at least get an opinion saying, okay, you engage in a sole source contract, but you've investigated this and you find that it is perfectly appropriate. There were good reasons for the state buying this property from you, and it's perfectly okay.
You wouldn't send it to the Attorney General past performance tells us that's what.
Well, if we're going to set up ethics agencies for each branch of government, then it might not be necessary to send it to the Attorney General. That's again what we've got in mind here by making these fairly broad and covering a lot of different conduct that might ordinarily not be covered. We want to guard against appearances of that something is wrong, and refer those matters to the ethics agency and let the ethics agency issue something or give it a clean bill of health.
Go ahead, Senator.
Let me give you a suppose. Is it possible we could put in there that every contract that the legislator had must be a competitive contract?
Something like that certainly could be done. But are there situations where a legislator has a certain piece of property that the state needs badly and is the only source for that piece of property?
They could put it up as competitive. They say define the parcel and everything else, it would be a competitive deal. You couldn't move one piece of land over to another. So just put it as a competitive bid, and I bet you could get away from a lot of the tribes.
Certainly.
Rather than, what I mean is don't allow sole source contracts. And
yeah, absolutely.
That's the idea.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine. If the city is satisfied with that, that'd be fine with us. It'd make things much simpler.
Representative Walker's comment.
Just one thing, that when he was telling us how he would view a contract being reviewed, he definitely said something like, the ethics group would say, yes, you had a piece of property that was special and it was quite all right for the state to have purchased. I would hope this would happen before.
Sure.
Okay.
Contracts within a certain period of time, whether it be 12 months or 6 months or some period of time of termination, again, give rise to the implication that you are contracting with your buddy still in state government. And that, again, like Senator Ray mentioned, it may be a sweetheart deal. And so it that kind of thing, I think we want to guard against the appearances that something is going on that is not in the public interest. And to the extent that contracts of that nature should be referred to some outside review, I think that would be appropriate.
It'd be pretty tough for a legislator, though.
For conversation, yeah. That.
So you're going on to number two, which is
attorneys. You're referring to attorneys there, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. It would be attorneys, and to some extent, certainly the exception refers to attorneys. The prohibition itself would refer to any kind of compensation. I think compensation here is the key word. That when you are representing the public, that you ought not to be representing for compensation some other private agency or entity. I think that's certainly an appropriate provision.
Dean, keep going here.
Okay. Number three, assisting a person in business for compensation within 12 months of termination or any matter which the public official took action. That again is a very broad prohibition, and it would prohibit, for example, a state commissioner who had some dealings with for example, state leases in certain matters. Then all of a sudden, quitting work, going to the company that ended up with those leases. I think again, we're talking about the appearance of that kind of thing just does no good. And
yeah, but when you say any manner of cheese, does that mean,
again, these are
thousands and thousands of things that come up before a commissioner or a public official. He even forgets that along with general, he has no intent, and somebody will pick it out.
These are intentionally written very broadly to cover a wide range of, and again, it's not something that I don't expect to see this wording in any piece of legislation. We're asked to bring up an outline, and we intentionally wrote it through a lot.
But don't we do this sort of now, that when someone leaves office, a legislator leaves office, he cannot go to work for anything out there that he created in office? Or
what kind of for the state, they don't keep you to work, you want to work for us.
In private, this would broaden that.
It carries on that same theme, and it just broadens it crazy.
The way I read this is it's also applied to directors and so forth, whereas right now, guys can just say, I'm a director of this, tomorrow I'm a hotshot businessman, multi-million-dollar.
For instance, the public members or even the commissioners of the Alaska Power Authority could then go to work, or could not go to work for the Alaska Power Authority, or any of those projects.
That would be the idea, that somebody who is regulating an industry
had set up a situation that they could almost walk right into.
Sure.
That's what we're trying to avoid.
That's right.
Well, I think we're going to have to change the citizen type legislature to a non-citizen and non-interest group that don't have anything, don't want anything, and don't expect to get anything. Those would be legislators and state officials from now on. Could we get a raise before?
Number four, the question of state loans was addressed by the first speakers, and seems to be adequately addressed in some of the other legislation.
So this would prohibit any ADA loans, any fishing loans,
any of
commercial anything.
What is contemplated, and the language that probably ought to be in here is something of the nature where the standards for getting a loan are fairly well defined, but there isn't a whole lot of discretion involved in giving out this loan or in reviewing this loan once it's been given out. If there is that
that there is a great deal of discretion, then again, you've got the appearance that somebody in a position of influence may be exerting that influence to get that loan or to continue it.
Hang on just a second. Let's look at this. If I was a director of a bank, let's say I was a director of NBA, for instance, the NBA directors are allowed to get loans at NBA, but they have to jump through a couple of more hoops to do that. In other words, when the federal auditors come in, they do a spot check of the bank loans that the bank let to make sure that they follow the right criteria and that. But they audit every single loan that the directors were given. And the loan officer, when you go before NBA, and I checked purposely with the banks to see if the directors could get loans within that bank, the loan officer comes before the entire board of directors, and that portfolio is laid out for everybody to see, the financial package and everything. When that director gets a loan, the whole world is seeing the laundry list, for instance.
Sure.
And I think if we're going to keep the concept of a citizen legislator, if so many of our legislators are commercial fishermen, that's their livelihood, or our attorneys are involved in commercial construction, for instance, to take that opportunity away to have state loans, that kind of makes them a sub-citizen. If every other citizen of the state could apply for this loan, and a legislator couldn't, or a public official couldn't, you're eliminating half the potential people of the state. So there has to be some mechanism, I would think, and I'm speaking for myself.
This loan is under 8.5 million. Any state loan is under 8.5 million.
Let's get some feeling of this in the committee. This is very important,
Barbara?
I would think.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that the difference between what you're saying and the state is that bank is in business for profit, and this state is subsidizing many of those loans that we're talking about, and that's why we may not be able to use the exact same criteria. I agree with you, there must be something.
I understand what you're saying. Finally come through with me after 19 years. We aren't in this job for to make a profit. This is a non-profit making job for me. I see. I could hit him with a profit making job.
Well, if I could drop some of these
attention. Could you hang on one more comment?
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to agree with the chairman on this. I think that, you know, like business loans, commercial loans, whatever, but I think it should, the word she used, a couple more hoops. Because we are, you know, after all, we're in a special position of, you know, getting information, but I don't want to make a full prohibition of the citizen legislator getting a commercial loan. I do believe he should go through a couple more hoops.
And
you should appear in front of the ethics committee.
Well, I mean, that type of approach, I think, is indicated on page 2 at the very top, where it says under A, disclosure of a conflict. What must you do if you've got a conflict, if your conduct falls within one of these categories? And what we've suggested is, first, you make a disclosure to, if you're in the executive branch, to your supervisor in the legislature, to the full body, and then you must immediately eliminate the conflict. In other words, divest your interest, get rid of your loan or whatever, or in the alternative, first of all, refrain from taking any action on that, and then seek an opinion from an ethics agency that's appropriate. Now, along
that's
those
exactly
same lines,
what you wanted to do. That's exactly what you suggested.
Along those same lines, maybe we ought to throw in some hoops, specifically on the loan, throw in some more hoops. I mean, make sure that prohibit loans except when there are sufficient safeguards in the administrative procedures leading up to getting those loans that would reduce the appearance of undue influence. And something along those lines, and then leave it up to the State Division of Loans to have a detailed set of regulations on when legislators come up before them for loans.
I have a loan. Everybody can see it on the piece of legislation and go around and say, oh yeah, you've got a loan, you're okay.
Representative Miller, do you have a talk? Senator Reyes, go to another committee meeting.
I didn't have any comment. I didn't answer really good, except I think we're going to run out of time. And this is actually what we need to do on a bill, not just so. I think it's excellent stuff, but I think we've got to keep moving down the list.
Please,
sir.
Okay.
I think number 5, use of government property for non-government purposes, speaks for itself. Although I'd hate to see people who use typewriters for their own purposes be dragged before some committee or somebody runs off and drops a copy or something. So that's why there's an exception for some sort of reimbursement system for things of that nature. Number 6, gifts. Certainly, I don't think anybody has any problems with that. discounts and other benefits which could be used to the advantage of the state, I think, is meant to prohibit the amigo fares, for example. If you don't want to prohibit them, then I think we ought to. I think we ought to say so. Could those things be used to the advantage of the state? I think that perhaps is one test. And if the state could use it, then the public official ought to be prohibited.
There's from one thing you need to know, Dean. The state goes out for competitive bid on almost all of their supplies, for furniture, paper, all of that kind of thing, except for travel. And there's a bill that's going to be introduced on the Senate side to demand that the state also have travel as a competitive bid process. They don't right now. And so I think we need to look at amigo fares. If the state is going to get a discount on their travel, then I would think we'd automatically be excluded from the general public amigo fare kind of thing. And I think that would probably be written into that contract, because I would rather the state get discounts on all of its travel, in air travel, for instance, than to have various members of the public getting amigo fares. So you need to think about that.
Sure. I think that's, you might want to draft it sort of like some of these national firms have these national contests, and they exclude the employees.
Sure.
Fan concept. I just think amigo fares, I truly believe that the state employees should have been going.
Please.
I guess just raise the other flag. I don't know why this big fuss about the amigo fares just come up. It's up to each supervisor to indicate whether or not the legitimate travel is indeed legitimate. And if it is, if the employee gets an amigo fare, or he gets a free lunch on the flight, or whatever in the process, what difference does it make? Particularly if the price is going to be the same with or without it. For the life of me, I have not yet figured out what was the big fuss about that, what that was all about. If travel is not authorized, then we ought to be very stingy with travel. And if it's not authorized, then it's no problem. But if it is authorized, if there's justification for it, and all the fares are the same, if an employee wants to take his wife with him and there's a discount for that, I don't see anything wrong with that. As long as the state is not being is not losing any money in the process. If you can work out something so you can get competitive things for the state, probably the carriers themselves will put in that sort of qualification. But in the absence of the carrier doing it, I don't think it's any of the state's business. It's just up to each supervisor and each employee, and for that matter, each legislator, to justify the travel and what the little Benny that somebody gets on the travel from one carrier over another is.
I
just have to say that as I understood the amigo fare thing, and no one has questioned it, was that number one, you couldn't get the special discount, that you had to pay the regular fare, and you can save about a third of your fare by getting that special discount by buying your ticket a week in advance. Did these people do that? Did they buy regular fare? Who paid the difference? And then you had to pay an additional $100. So I think there's a lot more to it, Mike, than just saying it's a Benny like a lunch. I mean, you need to check that out. What you did is you kind of set up a situation where people would be inclined to not get their tickets a week in advance. I don't even know, do we do that normally?
We try to. Okay. From what I understood on my research.
Before we get excited about it, I'd like to see statistics to show that people in substantial numbers did indeed delay getting their tickets, and therefore not eligible for the citizen service or something like that.
Continue, please.
It's
probably a mute issue anyway.
We're
going to take
care of it. Number seven suggests we prohibiting substantial financial dealings between employees and supervisors. And I suppose the danger there is that someone's evaluation and perhaps pay raises and promotions could be influenced by the extent to which that they have financial dealings with their supervisors. With prohibiting representatives from different branches of government, I think other considerations are involved, but again, there's the appearance that any kind of substantial financial dealing between the legislators and division directors or commissioners has, it just doesn't look good, and that is, again, is something that perhaps ought to be referred to the ethics agency for an opinion as to the specifics of the financial dealings and whether there is any possibility that someone's official judgment could be affected by that. Number eight, use of confidential information for non-government purposes, I think it's self-explanatory, as is number nine.
Well, go into nepotism, though. What did you have in mind there?
Well, and just in the authority that public officials have to hire and fire, give raises and
would this be within
people.
The same branch, for instance, the legislator's wife could work in the Department of Administration or could?
No, I haven't thought about it that far, but it would probably be restricted to again the same branch of government or something you may want to extend it to something an agency you have substantial influence over, such as some of the other
Senator
Hoffman. Yeah, I answered the question on behalf of my wife, who works for free for me and has for a long time, but she substantially objects to discrimination on the basis of happening to be married, when a lot of other circumstances exist that have the same effect in terms of household income.
See, you were brushing right over that one, but it wasn't as simple as there are a lot of questions there, especially in the state with the original premise that we have a small population to draw on. We come down here for the legislative
limited outside the state as far as employment is concerned, particularly here in Juneau. I know there.
This one's not easy. It's not that easy.
Well, but
continue, please.
I don't think I would want to put my wife on the payroll anyway, just in terms of perception, I think that's what I'm operating on. But I think there are other situations that probably should be on the payroll.
But what I hear you saying is that if, say, a spouse could not work, you said that where a legislator has influence over departments, well, potentially that legislator you can lock the spouse out in all the departments. And then what I'm trying to emphasize is that, a one industry town here, state employment, and that spouse has to look for private in the private industry.
Right.
Very little.
Like I said, these are very
good,
and they're
we're just pointing them out.
Again, I agree.
There has to be some specifics there, and it has to be within the Alaska framework. Okay. Go ahead.
Number 10 is the financial interest of the business or industry regulator or influenced by public official. Again, this is very broad and could. And the way it's written here could conceivably prohibit owning stock in a certain industry. Stock in the oil and gas industry, I suppose, for a number of executive branch officials and probably for all legislators, would be covered. And I think what is important is appearances. What's important is the degree to which your investment could be affected by any action you take, and whether or not some ethics agency is going to view your ownership of stock or ownership of interest in an oil field somewhere as potentially affecting your judgment.
But Dean, Commissioner Heath, for instance, can't own anything. He had to divest himself of all of his bank stocks, all of his bonds that he had. As Commissioner of Revenue, he was very susceptible to conflict of interest, and the AG made him get rid of everything.
Well, I mean, he specifically deals with a lot of financial institutions, and maybe it was appropriate that he do that. The question is, should some official in the Department of Natural Resources divest himself of all of his stock of Exxon?
Or how about mining claims?
Or mining claims. I mean,
that would be a real problem in DNR, I would think, this various mining claims. Senator Hoffman, you had a question or a comment?
When we get to the end, I can go through one series that hits on, looks like number 1, number 10, and number 11.
Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Okay, I'll just, the series, of course, is my own operation. That's why I'm going to ask you a question. I own Sentinel Lodge and Flying Service on the Canal Highway. I've had that business since the end of 1972. It's an air taxi operation, licensed under the State Transportation Commission. The Transportation Commission regulations require that you hold yourself out to anyone that wants to fly. Prior to being in the legislature, I did extensive flying for the Department of Fish and Game and a number of other agencies, both state and local government. The conflict of interest makes it impossible to comply with the APC law in terms of being able to fly. You can't follow both laws and they're in conflict. Also, that piece of property happens to be the only place within 50 miles where you can land a large airplane on wheels and a float plane. So Fish and Game has consistently wanted to use that for a base for any kind of field check station or anything else. they come to me and ask if they can do it. Anything that, that since I've been in the legislature, basically what's happened, if I stop flying to Fisher Game, the result is that they hire another air taxi operator who flies in and charges the deadhead time to my base of operations, operates off of my airport for no compensation to me because it would be a conflict. Charges the state more money and does the work. They also have a fuel dump there for no compensation. Now they're interested in putting a check station in there for the management because there's no other place that they can check both wheel and float airplanes within that game management area. But it hits, as you're talking about, number one, contracts with the state, also a financial interest in a business or industry regulated, and also it's an investment in property and financial matter.
Well, it's all three. One of those folks, the AG, wants to see at the end of
it was specifically, each one of those operations existed as it has now before I was ever in the legislature. And in fact, I stopped flying, and anything I provided, I provided for free. Or at some point, if it's that much of a problem, I'll just say, no, don't do it.
Well, let me just say that if you were to appear before an ethics agency on that problem, you probably shouldn't bother hiring yourself an attorney because you've adequately represented yourself on that issue.
But the point is, how do you set up a system to deal with that, particularly in the direct conflict in the existing law on the Transportation Commission and the existing opinion on conflict of interest? I can't follow both laws. I've made the determination not to fly for the state, but in fact, by doing that, I'm acting contrary to the ATC regulations in terms of holding myself out to anybody that wants to fly.
Well, I don't know that there's necessarily a conflict between the ATC regulations and conflict interest provisions. It could just be, we'll just interpret that to mean that those persons who have a conflict, in other words, whose conduct is otherwise prohibited by law, don't have to make their services available to all comers. So I would think it'd be as simple as that. I'm not prepared to deal with that.
I think
what that is,
it illustrates the complexity.
Yeah, what it does, it illustrates the complexity and also illustrates
it
illustrates how broadly these are set out here. It also illustrates the broad range of activities that legislators and other public officials engage in, perhaps legitimately so, and ought to be allowed to continue to engage in those activities.
Should we have Dean go over page 3 of the ethics agency, or should we save that for next time? What is the president's committee? I have Mr. Barrier's here, and I'd like him to have a few minutes to go over the uniform rule. Yes.
What is preceding Thursday? Of the matters to be taken up next week. And in order that